Today's show is sponsored by Audible. Go to audiblepodcast.com/Dan Carlin for your free 30-day trial.
You know, he just doesn't believe we have to destroy what made this country great in order to save it. Common Sense with Dan Carlin.
You're not going to hear the audio that we did yesterday because it sucked. And it sucked because I couldn't keep my mind on, you know, the subject I was talking about. It kept drifting off into a subsidiary issue that wasn't what I wanted to address, because I'm not sure, you know, sometimes I'm not sure how it helps. I'm trying to make what we do here relevant to you. You know, after 300 shows, I find myself falling into ruts all the time. I mean, you know, you're going to hear some Fourth Amendment stuff, aren't you? Because Dan likes to talk about that, and it's one of the key issues that's threatening today. And, you know, once upon a time, we had a much wider range of subject matter we would deal with. As the era that we live in has become so obviously more and more important and transformative, things really boil down to a couple of key, really important points nowadays. And so the show tends to focus on them as you factor, you know, whatever issue you're looking at down to its root causes, which, as I say, boils down to often similar things. And in yesterday's program, I was trying to just do what I like to think was a balanced analysis of where the election is right now, you know. And I kept going off into territory where there would be these very long pauses. Because I was speechless. I sometimes, you know, I'm one of these people, and you know this, and some of you criticize me for it, and I understand it, and I guess that plays into the whole thing, but I'm a flexible guy. And I try to be. I mean, I like to say that wisdom requires a flexible mind, and I try to live up to the hype with that a little bit. Try to see things from the other person's viewpoint, because I think it helps. But oftentimes people will say that that's the equivalent of not having any firm convictions, right? You know, I'm just totally able to morph into any sort of moral space I want to. But I do have some red lines. They're just few and far between. But when you get to them, they are so uncompromising. And they go against my typical personality most of the time that I'm almost at war with myself. My wife will say sometimes, you have to just let a little thing go. But when you get to my moral red lines, I no longer let little things go. And it's at that point that I realize, you know, try as I might to be this flexible character, I think I am at heart a moralist. And I'm not necessarily comfortable with that. I'm also somebody, because maybe I'm a moralist, who recognizes my own hypocrisies, and I have many of them. I'm a meat lover, for example, and if I had to kill the animals myself, we'd be eating nothing but vegetables forever. So we'll start with my long list of hypocrisies right there. So if something I say lumps you in, you know, with some group of hypocrites here, just know that I'm there with you, and probably 98% of the rest of us are too. The non-hypocrites out there are rare. Yesterday I was talking about, and let me start off with this so that everybody understands, there was one thing I really wanted to say in yesterday's show, that if I just focus on, you know, the stuff that made me speechless in yesterday's show, which is what I'm going to try to do today, this will get left out, and I don't want it to. So often when I see protests these days, I see them as counterproductive, not because the protests themselves are, but because the way they're done, and sometimes the idea behind the way they're done, is so counterproductive long-term to what the people want and their own self-interests. I mean, I'll give you an example. There is a segment, in the same way that I don't catalog Trump supporters as all one type of people, unlike the media, I recognize he has varying levels of support amongst bunches of different groups. The anti-Trump people are the same way. But there is a percentage of them that think it's all right to shut Donald Trump's speech down. And he's already had at least one rally canceled for public safety reasons because the protesters made it unsafe. I've read a bunch of stories from neutral sources that say that it was, you know, let's put it this way, that the people who were protesting were taking some pride in the fact that these things were being shut down. They were yelling, shut it down at some of this. And I think that's just wrong. And you're hurting your own best weapon when you do that, by the way. You are going to hurt your own free speech by doing that. And you don't believe me? What are you going to do in a month or 2 months when you decide to hold some big rally and your supporters come out and you have all these different activist groups and speakers set up and everything, and 2,000 Donald Trump supporters show up and hold hands and don't let your people through, or chant so loud you can't hear anything, or make the situation so potentially unsafe that you cancel it so your supporters, you know, aren't in any danger? Are you going to say, oh, well, we did it to them? Or are you going to say, there's another example of Donald Trump's brown shirt tactics to shut down free speech, blah, blah? I mean, folks, don't you see that you just legitimized that tactic? You took an ends justifies the means approach. Trump is so evil, racist, xenophobic, you know, fill in the blank, that it's okay to shut his free speech down, and you weakened your own free speech rights. That's why so many court cases dealing with free speech, you have the justices talking about how, in order to preserve your own free speech rights and everybody else's, you have to be willing to put up with speech that is hateful to you. One of the great ones, Louis Brandeis, in 1927, in a court case writing about free speech, wrote, quote, "Those who won our independence by revolution were not cowards. They did not fear political change. They did not exalt order at the cost of liberty. To courageous, self-reliant men with confidence in the power of free and fearless reasoning applied through the processes of popular government, no danger flowing from speech can be deemed clear and present, unless the incidence of the evil apprehended is so imminent that it may befall before there is opportunity for full discussion. If there be time to expose through discussion the falsehoods and fallacies, to avert the evil by the processes of education, the remedy to be applied is more speech, not enforced silence." End quote. More speech. Oliver Wendell Holmes Jr. in United States versus Schwimmer, 1929, another justice of the court, wrote, quote, "If there's any principle of the Constitution that more imperatively calls for attachment than any other, it is the principle of free thought. Not free thought for those who agree with us, but freedom for the thought we hate." End quote. And in this country, one of the dangers we face is suggesting that hateful speech is the same as harmful speech. Certainly there's a line there somewhere, but when you can, you know, argue that speech is harmful is when it can be restricted. You can't yell fire in a crowded theater, right? If you can reclassify what today we call hateful speech into harmful speech, you can begin to restrict that. And as I said, be careful. You may think you're involved in some great justice when you do that, but hateful and harmful and all those things are an eye of the beholder question. Be careful you don't find that somebody decides that something that's important to you, that you're speaking out about, isn't hateful or harmful to them. There's a reason sometimes that these rights being absolute are important, and that's because we all have different definitions and lines. It's much better if it's not open to too much interpretation. So I wanted to make sure that that got out there, because I felt, you know, once again, just like on campuses across the country, you know, you play with your free speech rights at your own risk. And for those of you who are activists, it would be worth remembering that free speech is the greatest weapon activists have in this country. And it's a golden rule kind of freedom. You know, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. And it's all kind of structured like a web. And you cannot reduce their free speech rights without weakening the web as a whole. You know, and your free speech rights are in that same environment. So yesterday's show had a bunch of that in it, too. Couldn't focus on it, though. Kept getting sidetracked. Couldn't get past the Donald Trump comments. And couldn't get past the fact that, you know, they were working, at least with some of us. Now, obviously, Trump's made a lot of comments, so I have to be a little bit more specific about the ones I can't get out of my head. But they have to do with basic sort of American values. And I can't quite get my mind around, not that politicians or our leaders would contradict those values, but that they would run on a platform promising to do that and then do well when they did. Specifically, it's when Trump talks about how the United States should treat terrorism suspects or their families. Let me read you some excerpts from a couple of stories. then we'll at least have some background for, you know, what I'm thinking here. This one is from Tuesday, March 22nd, 2016. It's a Reuters piece by John Whitesides, and it's headlined, "Trump backs waterboarding and a lot more is in quotes, after Brussels attacks." Dateline Washington, quote, "Republican presidential frontrunner Donald Trump said on Tuesday the United States should use waterboarding and other harsh interrogation techniques when questioning terror suspects, and renewed his calls for tougher U.S. border security after the attacks in Brussels. The billionaire businessman said authorities, quote, should be able to do whatever they have to do, end quote, to gain information in an effort to thwart future attacks." This is Trump talking now, quote, "Waterboarding would be fine. If they can expand the laws, I would do a lot more than waterboarding," Trump said on NBC's Today program, adding that he believed torture could produce useful leads. Quote, "You have to get the information from these people," end quote. Later on in the story, and this shows you how weird our environment has become, the story says about waterboarding, quote, "Critics call it torture," end quote. You know, one of the more slick little moves in this whole use of, and I'm using air quotes with my fingers now, enhanced interrogation, is the rebranding of it. It's a very lawyerly move where you just kind of say, well, listen, you know, if we say that, yes, we do this, but this isn't torture, then we're not torturing. You know, you have to kind of look at the long-term view on things like waterboarding, because the moment the United States decided waterboarding was okay to do as a policy because it wasn't torture was the first time that we decided it wasn't. The United States had long considered it torture. In fact, we court-martialed soldiers in the field. You know, Trump is fond of comparing our lack of desire or willingness to use these tools to some sort of weakness or political correctness. Well, they weren't very politically correct in the 1890s and early 1900s. We court-martialed, you know, soldiers in the field in the Philippines for doing this. In the Vietnam War, in the 1960s, we court-martialed soldiers in the field for doing this. These were brought up at war crimes trials after the Second World War. I believe John McCain said the other day, didn't he, that we hung people for this. Nonetheless, the United States is one of a group of countries that after the Second World War became the leaders in what you could call maybe international morality. The laws of war, all these kinds of things, and this is how we prosecuted people and a large chunk of the attorneys who made this international law, you know, and who sought these convictions on these grounds were our people. Fast forward to now. I mean, when it became public in the 2004, right around there, that the United States was involved in this enhanced interrogation activity after 9/11, the government was upset with the disclosure, obviously. And there were good reasons why. I mean, you know, nobody wants their operational secrets of what they're doing behind the scenes broadcast to the world. That's just common sense. But the government also knew there'd be a backlash on moral grounds. That treating captives in this fashion would be seen as a violation of our principles, going back on our branding and marketing and doing something that was obviously crossing the Rubicon in terms of official behavior on the part of the country. The country did not officially torture people as part of a program at any time in its history. Now, this is not to be naive. The United States, like a bunch of other countries, sort of had third-party outsourcing torturing available to it all during the Cold War. Some foreign agent or something ends up in some country that happens to torture their own people. They may torture this guy. If they torture this guy and anything of interest that the United States might care about comes out, we'll just phone us, or maybe we'll have a CIA agent there, you know, just in case there are some translation issues. So let's not be naive. Again, it's a different kind of Rubicon when it's an official program with memos and legal opinions and psychologists working on it too, and that's a torture program. It's the difference between being able to wash your hands after something nasty in the international field happens and doing it yourself. Maybe it's a hypocritical distinction to make, but I've already copped to being a hypocrite. We did two shows on torture back to back, I remember, back in 2008. And I remember, I think, that the vociferousness. Is that a good way to put it, Ben? Ben, of course, the tortured Harvey White Rabbit figure around here. People were upset with me. I think they were surprised how moralistic I got on the torture issue when we did the show in May 2008 called Mad About Torture, show 125. I had the White Rabbit look that up. The very next show, though, is also about torture because I'm dealing with the reaction that came my way after listeners heard Mad About Torture. A lot of them were mad about me. Lots of people saying they were going to cancel their subscriptions and donations and all this stuff. They were angry with my level of anger, I guess. And so the next show was entitled The Way You Play the Game. And that's from a phrase. It's not whether you win or lose, it's how you play the game. And to me, that's the opposite approach to an ends justifies the means mindset. And my argument was that the United States is not an ends justify the means country, that we can't be and still remain true to the marketing slogans and the branding. And if you're like me, you buy into that stuff. So it grates on you when you still hear the branding in a bumper sticker-like way, and it clashes so much with the reality you see around them, which are political candidates trying to garner votes by promising to do things that when it became apparent in 2004 that we were doing some of these things, there was a big backlash and the government wished it hadn't come out. You know, a dozen years later, it's a campaign promise in order to secure votes. I'm trying to get my mind around what that says about us. And the upsetting and tempting thing to say is that somehow these terrorists have managed to gain an important sort of victory over us. You know, there are really two sides to this terrorism defense-offense deal, isn't there? One side is making sure you protect yourself physically from bombings and attacks and all that kind of stuff, and that's certainly what we focus on. But the other side is trying and attempting to maintain our values in a system where those values are challenged by the demands of things like protecting our safety. They're at odds. It's easy to mouth the values of the country when there's no challenge. There's nothing, you know, when you're talking about defending freedom, no big deal when freedom's not on the line and you don't have to do anything. It's a bigger deal when it is. And I think sometimes we think it's the job of our soldiers to go kick ass to defend freedom. But we're all in this fight, and it's a different kind of thing. And part of what, you know, we're defending here when we say things like, we are not going to cross a line and target the families of terrorists. It's just, you know, beyond the pale. We won't do that to be safe, is you're protecting our ideals. I mean, how much is that worth? And the funny thing about it is it sounds like you're taking the idealistic hippie squishhead non-realist viewpoint when you say that, and that the realist, the Donald Trump types, the one who's not politically correct, he's willing to get, I'm about results and what you have to do is this. I don't think so. I think it's akin to what I said earlier about the protesters who were celebrating shutting down Donald Trump rallies and not realizing that they were cutting off their nose to spite their face. I think the question of using waterboarding and a lot more, as Donald Trump says, I think all of that is a short-term approach that is guaranteed. If you looked at this in a cold business sense, it is guaranteed to have downsides, bunch of guaranteed downsides, a couple of potential upsides. I mean, how many attacks would you have to thwart and how many people would you have to save to make it worth what you lose? And lives are real things, right? Physical damage to buildings and costs, those are real things. You can't really, if you're like an insurance company, you can't insure the national values and ideals, can you? I mean, how would you evaluate them? What's the dollar value of the national reputation? I think from a pure business standpoint, what you lose, for example, in just the war on terror, which is a hearts and minds war. I mean, we're here to champion the side of Islam that doesn't believe in the things ISIS believes in, or anything close to that. And in order to appear like the good guys, there are certain rules we have to follow, certain limitations that we must put on ourselves in order to live up to the hype. Otherwise, we become a little bit more. Let's not equate head slicers and people who burn people alive and such with anything we do, but a little bit more like them, while giving them bulletin board material to recruit and to draw false equivalencies and to create lines of sympathy. Seems to me you would have to get a great amount of value from any torture program to ever make up for what you would lose in a realistic sense in terms of moral high ground and everything else. I mean, the moral high ground is a weapon in the war on terror. Don't kid yourself. But even though we've had these discussions, like I said, I mean, we did the show The Way You Play the Game, and I was loud and angry and holier than thou, which, like I said, you know, you get me on these, I don't have very many red lines, but when you get me on them, it's preachy time, you know? I could never have envisioned candidates running on platforms where the campaign promises were not just to do this, but to do it more. And the terrorist family thing, you know, when we talk about Donald Trump being a singular candidate, there's no analogy. There's no past presidential hopeful you could point to that looks anything like this guy in terms of, you know, comparisons. It's all apples and oranges if you're comparing Trump to any candidate I've ever seen in this country. I mean, nobody would ever say anything like what Trump said in a visit with the people on Fox one day. I've got a CNN story from December 3rd, 2015 by Tom Lobianco explaining, you know, what happened on The Appearance. And the headline is, Donald Trump on terrorists, take out their families, from the beginning of the piece, quote. Donald Trump said Wednesday that he would kill the families of terrorists in order to win the fight against ISIS. The billionaire businessman, the story says, was asked by the host of Fox News' Fox and Friends how to fight ISIS, but also minimize civilian casualties when terrorists often use human shields. This is Trump speaking now. Quote, the other thing with the terrorists is you have to take out their families. When you get these terrorists, you have to take out their families. They care about their lives. Don't kid yourself. When they say they don't care about their lives, you have to take out their families, Trump said. End quote. Trump is unapologetically an ends justifies the means candidate, folks, but this is not traditionally an ends justifies the means country. We can't just do things based on whether they work or not. We have to go about it a certain way. It's sort of the prohibition on, and I'm using air quotes here, the good guys, end quote, isn't it? Superman can face the bad guy, and the bad guy can put all the civilians in danger in order to, you know, keep Superman at bay. But Superman has to, you know, he has to go care about the civilians. I mean, he's in a terrible problem here, isn't it? He's got to save civilians from the bad guy and still get the bad guy. And the bad guy can put the civilians in harm's way. I mean, you know, the good guy traditionally has constraints to work around. Now, you may say, Dan, we're not burning ISIS people to death. There's your constraint right there. But I would suggest that, you know, we're not discussing what we've done here, if that's all we focus on, what we've done here since 9/11, and what is continuing to move in terms of the goalpost, if opinions like Trump continue to gain, you know, adherence, is that we're becoming okay with something that our grandparents considered to be actions that only the bad guys that we fought did. We're becoming comfortable with what our opponents in times that we've often portrayed in almost good and evil terms, you know, we're becoming more comfortable with their kind of thinking, if not their exact actions. And you may say, well, listen, Dan, we may waterboard, or I may favor waterboarding, and yes, the Soviets might have waterboarded too, but they also had gulags and, you know, straight-up truncheon beatings and all these kinds, and we're not doing that. Yes, you're right. I'm not equating them as equal. I'm saying you've crossed a line where now you're on their side. You're not as bad as they are, but you're on their side of the line. That used to be a pretty hard and fast line when I was growing up, and 9/11 changed that. And this idea that somehow either it's necessary, you know, then one asks why it was not necessary in the Cold War to have a policy at the national level about torturing, or in the Second World War. And there's a reason we didn't do that. What was it, and what's changed? Now, sometimes when you get into an argument with some of these people, I'm not going to mention any names, but they have a tactic. It's a debating tactic for reducing any historical evidence to a meaningless thing. In other words, they cut out any arguments based on past experience, right? Your evidence doesn't matter because this is unlike anything that's ever happened before. The war on terror is apples and oranges from anything, Dan. So none of the historical experience you bring up is relevant to this because this is, you know, unlike anything else. And just so you know, folks, this is the argument that is always made whenever any debater wants to reduce any historical evidence to meaninglessness. So you might as well say, every situation that's ever happened in the world is different, so past experience is never relevant. And we'll just cut to the chase there. Nonetheless, you also cannot argue that somehow, you know, we are weak or politically correct now, and that that's why we won't do whatever it takes to get the information we need or whatever it is Trump wants to say. Because folks, I mean, our grandparents didn't do it. They weren't weak. They weren't politically correct. They didn't do it 100 years ago either. This sort of stuff used to happen in police departments in certain localities. I mean, you didn't want to end up in certain police stations in the 1930s when they wanted you to confess to something. They'd hit you on the head with a phone book till you did. That sort of stuff is very different, though, let's understand, than a national torture program. And I have a hard time finding common ground with people who think it's okay. I'm devoid of my normal tools for having a, you know, useful discussion with people, flexibility, understanding, trying to see things from their point of view. I become a moralist, a redliner, and I'm difficult to talk with. And I run out of things to say because it's not an argument. I mean, sometimes with moral issues, you know, you realize it's not a logical discussion to be won on the merits of your arguing ability. Sometimes it's just a, you know, right and wrong deal. And if you think it's right and I think it's wrong, there is nothing to discuss. We differ on the fundamental point. We're crossing a Rubicon here. Dan, I see no river at all. I don't know what you're talking about. I went around trying to find some sort of evidence of a trend. I was looking at poll numbers from the last about 10 years is what's out there, because that's when the real torture debate hit. They weren't having waterboarding and torture discussion and poll taking in the 1970s because they didn't think there was any reason to. We didn't do that. But so since, you know, it became public knowledge that some of this was going on, they've been taking polls asking for Americans' opinions on the subject, and they're all over the place. Some show that as we continue to go forward, more and more people become comfortable with this. Others show that that's not the case. And what it really shows is how much these polls are influenced by who's asking them and how the questions are phrased and what have you. It does seem pretty apparent that a sizable chunk, at least 35% of the U.S. public, is pretty comfortable with the enhanced interrogation techniques that we've used, you know, that we know about in the past. I know of no poll out there that's been done on the reaction to Trump's comments about the families of terrorists. And, you know, he's kind of walked that back. He'll do something where he'll say something, and then as soon as there's a firestorm of reaction, he'll walk it back like he just did that, I think it was yesterday, with an abortion comment. I don't know if he walked back the taking out of the... I read where he said in one of the stories that takeout did not mean kill. But then later on after that, he was in a Republican debate where Rand Paul said we would have to withdraw from the Geneva Convention because what Trump was suggesting was a war crime. So Trump didn't deny it at that point. My point is that I don't think we've ever had a presidential candidate ever who promised to commit war crimes or advocated it or said, you know, here's what we have to do, implying that when I'm elected, that is what we'll do. That's what I mean about apples and oranges. Can you imagine any other presidential candidate that you can even think of who would say something like, you know, we have to take out some innocent lives here deliberately? I mean, come on, we all understand. You decide to carpet bomb Germany in the Second World War, you're killing lots of people who are women and children and all that, and it's all understandable. It's a totally different thing than saying, okay, we've got this terrorist, and it's Osama bin Laden, and here's his wife, and here are his children. Let's go get them. I mean, it's, folks, if you don't see the difference between them, then, as I said, there'll just be a long moment of silence, and I'm not sure how to argue that. I can't get my mind around certain things, though, and these flashes of questions just go off in my head, and there's no point to them, and there's no argument to them, but, I mean, I think about this, for example. Who do you get to be a torturer? If you decide that this is going to be a program that we have to have, you know, who gets that job? And if they're a Christian, for example, do they take the job? I mean, can you inside? Maybe I don't know. I mean, to me, looking at it the way I look at it, I mean, the person at the center of their religion was a tortured person who ended up, you know, dying in a tortured way. And the instrument he died and was tortured upon has become the symbol of the faith that a lot of people wear around their necks. Could they wear that around their necks while they waterboarded somebody? I don't know. It doesn't seem like it would work to me. I would be interested if a poll were taken of the people that think this is a good idea in the American public, you know, what their other beliefs were. I'd be very interested to know, you know, how one meshes with the other, how somebody internalizes that, or if they even do. I will say this. While I'm certain that there is always a percentage of people in the country who have an ends justify the means mentality, I think it's a personality type, personally. I think Dick Cheney's an end justifies the means guy. And sometimes I think you want those kind of people. It depends on what they're doing, right? There's a place for every personality type. I also think there's people who are how you play the game people. And I'm a how you play the game person. And I think there's a bunch of people like me too. And I think same thing. There's places you want us and places you probably don't. I think the great mass of human beings probably fall into the middle where they're flexible. Or shall we say, fluid. And it depends on what you might say in a business setting, the externals. If it's the 1970s and very few Americans are worried about terrorism, well, then they become how you play the game people, and more of those people move over into that side of the ledger. All of a sudden, we have a 9/11 and some other terror attacks, and the fear gets ratcheted up, and some anthrax attacks, and all these kinds of things, and a bunch of those people, I think, fluidly move more over into we have to do whatever it takes to keep a safe territory, which is an ends justify the means side of the ledger. To me, it looks like what terrorism has done in this country, really, you know, you don't want to say the world. I'm having a hard time trying to figure out, you know, a good phrase that represents all of the places that are sort of on top of what's going on, because there's a lot of the world that couldn't care less about what the rest of the world's doing. They have their own lives. They're operating in just fine territory, you know, in this country that's not really a part of any of your concern. I mean, so you know what I mean, but it's not just the United States. I mean, there's a lot of people within the sound of my voice hearing it, you know, in Japan or the Pacific Rim or Europe or wherever, even the Middle East, let's be honest, who can see that this terrorism is changing us. And the longer that we deal with it, the more it's going to become a generational thing. So instead of changing the generation that lives through it, in other words, you know, the Second World War or the Great Depression, these are things that scarred a generation. And you'll hear people say that it scarred a generation. But when you look at something like the Cold War, and, you know, increasingly, certainly what the so-called War on Terror looks like, this is something that's going to scar generations. And what happens when, and we've talked about this before, when you get a person who's two or three generations from any sort of memory of what it was like before there was a war on terror, and their entire idea of expectations are based on the expectations that 60 years of war on terror, you know, with 50 years of Cold War before that, you know, have heaped on top of their historical baggage, you know, cart. I mean, I think what we see right now around us is terrorism changing us. And some of you might think what it's really doing is making us more realistic, less politically correct, you know, finally waking up to the threat and the willingness to do what it takes to defeat the threat. But who are we going to be, you know, after we win? Do you think we're just going to be able to turn back into who we were a generation or two or three ago? Does it matter? Will it matter? You know, that we still mouth these slogans at ball games and patriotic events and with our bumper stickers and T-shirts if they really don't comport too much with the way we actually operate? Land of the free, home of the brave, but we'll take out your families if you're a terrorist. I mean, to me, there's a disconnect there, but a generation or two from now, maybe there won't be. A dozen years ago, the government knew we would freak out if we found out that we were waterboarding people because it's torture and Americans don't do that. A dozen years later, we got a candidate promising, as a campaign promise, to get votes to do that and more. A lot more, he said. I'm sorry, that's a lot of people moving over toward the ends justify the means side of our spectrum here. Whenever this threat goes away, if it ever goes away, how far are they going to be able to move back to the how you play the game side? Or is that gone forever? And if it's gone forever, what did terrorism take from us? There's a line from a movie, I can't remember where it's from, it just keeps popping into my head. That's what happened to the show yesterday. It was just totally derailed by random flashes of thoughts. But what have you done to me? There's a movie scene where somebody just said, what have you done to me? And that's how I feel about this terrorism thing. What have they done to us that we're even having these discussions? Should we or shouldn't we kill the family? And by the way, I don't want to magnify this out of proportion because the, you know, reaction to Trump's comments about taking out the families was swift and loud. So it wasn't like people went, well, let's consider that proposition. My point is, in a dozen years, we went as far as we did. I mean, what's it going to be like in a dozen more? We talked about in a show or two ago. I mean, you know, the 2020 election, it's going to be very interesting. These trends we're witnessing now are likely to simply be more advanced, evolved, and intense by then. And what does that even mean? I mean, at that point, do we have a bunch of candidates maybe, you know, vying to see who can promise to cross the Rubicon the farthest when it comes to what we're willing to do to keep us safe? Listen, when we're afraid, when we're agitated, when we're frustrated, calls to our higher selves often fall on deaf ears. And I think it's probably stereotypical to point out that that's the only time it really counts, isn't it? I mean, ideals are easy to have if they're not challenged, don't cost you anything, or don't come with any trade-offs that you'd rather not make. Again, if you think it's politically correct or hippie squish head, you know, bleeding heart-ish, I mean, ask why your grandparents didn't do it. And they were tough. My grandfather was tough. And he would have seen, the funny thing about it is, if you had gone to my grandfather, who was a tough half-Irish, half-German guy, but you know, we don't have Americans like that anymore. He was the kind of progressive liberal thinker who was tough as nails. It's personality types we're not used to seeing mixed in the same person anymore. And there were a lot of Americans like that back then because they were raised tough. But he was big on his fellow man and all that kind of stuff. But if you had said to him, we have a ticking time bomb and this guy, you know, is the one planting it and we just caught him and it's going to go off in 10 minutes if we don't find out where he planted it, my grandfather would be the first person to take a lit cigarette. He usually had one in his hand 24/7, you know, and start putting it all over the guy until they found out where the bomb was and then trusted that he could go to some jury afterwards being prosecuted for the mistreatment and convince them that in this specific, unusual, crazy, you know, who would have believed it would ever happen case, it was necessary, and trust that he would be let free. But if you said to him, no, we have to have a torture program where we do that to people so that we can find out where the next ticking time bomb may be, he would say, what are you, a Nazi? The reason I brought that up is because that's the example, the stereotypical classical example that gets thrown at you, the so-called ticking time bomb scenario. And the point that people like my grandfather would make is that you don't have to have a torture program to protect you from that. Society will protect the people who protect it in those situations. You don't have to have special exemptions in the law. It's an excuse. You know, President Obama has a line, and I like it. I'm not going to swear, but he says, don't do stupid crap. And that's sort of like a governing principle. It's not a bad idea. It's a good thing everybody should have on their wall, right? Don't do stupid crap. To me, if you can see a future black mark on America's reputation, just don't go there. I mean, how many incidents of sabotage would we have had to have prevented by locking Japanese Americans up in internment camps in the Second World War for that black mark to be worth it? I think experience has shown that we're not going to forget our black marks. All right, they're not going to be swept under the rug. And a generation or two afterwards, there's not going to be people going, well, you could understand how they felt. They're not going to be that way. You don't get judged, you know, that lightly by history. If you see a black mark in the future, could we just say, don't do stupid crap. Don't go there. You're going to regret that later. You're going to have a historical hangover if you do that. How many terrorist attacks would we have to prevent? This is assuming you buy into the idea that torture works, by the way. How many terror attacks would we have to thwart to make the loss, whatever you consider the loss to be here, you know, in terms of moving in a direction our grandparents wouldn't have gone in, worth it? And if you say, Dan, if we stop one nuclear attack, it's already worth it. You know, well, then I think we're operating under Dick Cheney's 1% doctrine, sort of. There was a book called The 1% Doctrine, and it's named after a Dick Cheney line where he said, quote, if there's a 1% chance that Pakistani scientists, for example, is what he means, are helping Al-Qaeda build or develop a nuclear weapon, we have to treat it as a certainty in terms of our response. It's not about our analysis. It's about our response. End quote. If you actually govern that way, though, and match your policies to that way of looking at things, if there's even a 1% chance that somebody will blow a nuclear weapon up in a U.S. harbor, then you legitimize anything, don't you? I mean, essentially what you're saying is, in order to protect ourselves, none of our national values mean anything. I guess I can't go there with you, because the whole thing that makes this country special, that the marketing materials celebrate, that we, you know, pledge allegiance to, all those kinds of things are those values. I mean, I understand realism, I understand protection, I understand fear, I understand all of that stuff. But does that mean that those values never meant anything but amorphous, easy to jettison unrealities that drift away and evaporate like mist when confronted by hard realities like bombs and blood and terror? And if so, why didn't that happen before? You know, I know people that will say to me, Dan, listen, this war on terror is like nothing we've ever faced in human history before, so all that stuff about our grandparents, they would have reacted just like we would have, but they didn't in times that are pretty darn bad. In other words, you know, those who fought the Second World War, in my opinion, we're involved in a conflict much more serious than what we're involved in now. And you may say, Dan, the potential for a nuclear weapon going off. Yes, 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 potential, schmenschel. The Third Reich is the Third Reich. And in the Cold War, we've never faced anything like that. We still face that. I mean, let's not kid ourselves. There's still a bunch of nuclear weapons aimed at us right now. It's easy to forget about that when we're worried about the potential of one dirty nuclear bomb in Manhattan, when you could talk about thousands of, you know, multiple independent reentry vehicle warheads smashing into U.S. cities and then, you know, 5 minutes later smashing in again to kill any survivors, which was the design, by the way, folks. So maybe we put our fear into perspective and remember that the people who used to have much more reverence, I would say, for the idea of how you play the game in terms of the way a country like the United States is supposed to operate in conjunction and in harmony with its stated ideals, or at least more harmony, that they faced absolute extinction. In fact, it was so hair trigger, it might even happen by accident. It wasn't a 1% doctrine. It was probably at times 50-50. Early 1980s, Cuban Missile Crisis in the 1960s. I mean, there were several times when the entire life as we know it on this planet could have been set back 3,000 years and permanent radioactivity everywhere. And guess what we didn't do? Have a torture program where we tortured people routinely as part of policy. Those politically correct grandparents of mine just didn't know how to get tough, I guess. Or they considered the value of the ideals to be worth a much higher price, potentially, than we do. And it might be worth asking how it came to be you know, that we change so much. And as I had said earlier in the program, maybe part of that is, you know, we're not a generation that is scarred by something like, you know, the Second World War. We are in the process of being part of a multi-generational scar that I'm not sure the country will ever fully heal from if we are not very careful about making sure that we preserve what it is we want to come out of this war on terror still with while we try to figure out how to win it. I love that quote, and I hit you with it maybe too often, I'm sorry, but I love it by Dwight Eisenhower, who is a president I would love to see in charge of the war on terror, actually, because I think he'd keep his eyes on the prize. He was a Nebraska farm boy, came from like a Norman Rockwell upbringing, had a romantic attachment to the ideals of America while he tried to incorporate those and protect those as much as he could while he's in a global life-or-death existential struggle of the kind America had never faced before, and the world hadn't either, the Cold War. And he summed up the problem of trying to keep, you know, the very things that are important to us as Americans, the marketing and the branding, and having a real truthful connection to those things, you know, from being destroyed as you try to keep yourself safe. And he said, and boy, does it resonate today. The problem in defense is how far you can go without destroying from within what you're trying to defend from without. I hate to engage in hyperbole, but if we jettison our values in order to fight the war on terror and keep ourselves safe, then we lose. And if we eventually, you know, come through on the other side of the war on terror, you know, there may still be a United States of America, but it will be fundamentally different in ways, well, that maybe we could argue about whether or not they're important. It's worth asking a fundamental question, though, is if you lose stuff like that, can you ever get it back? You know, when these wars end, like the First World War, you know, they talked about wanting to return, they coined a word, to normalcy. Are we ever going to return to normalcy? Are we even going to know what normalcy is or was by the time we get to a point where we can even contemplate that? How much of a war aim should it be to try to maintain who we are during the conflict? Because to me, I mean, that's the ultimate question of all. But remember, you know, I'm an inflexible moralist when it comes to this, and I can't be reasoned with. Audible is the internet's leading provider of spoken audio entertainment. Almost 200,000 audio titles to choose from. It's a giant audio bookstore with a huge range of offerings. Of course, there are audiobooks, but there's magazines, periodicals, newspapers, old-time radio shows, stand-up comedy bits, kids stuff, erotica, I mean, everything in between pretty much covers it all, right? I try to go on there and find books to recommend to you, books that I've read usually, so that I can say, listen, I've read this book, you'll like it too. And what's happening to me now all the time is I end up, before I find the book that I've read to recommend to you, I find something else and buy it, because it tempts me, and I'm imminently temptable, and 200,000 titles, well, that's a lot to tempt you with. In this case, I bought something that is so different than the stuff I normally read, and I'm excited to read it, believe it or not, just for the switch-up, because I'm reading, like, these heavy books, which I always do. You know, Adam Tooze, the economic historian's got one called The Deluge that's really interesting, but it's the kind that you camp out for a while with. It's serious, heavy, get the reading glasses kind of thing. You want to listen to something in your car, though? Something which I assume is going to be a little lighter than Adam Tooze, I can't imagine. I picked up one called Marvel Comics, The Untold Story, about 5 minutes ago. And I, you know, it's I have two kinds of books, the heavy and the light, and I'm missing out on the light stuff right now because I scream through it so fast because it's light. And I was a comic book fan in the 70s, and I thought to myself, really, you're not going to buy this. But I did. That's what happens. You know, you go on Audible, and you get tempted. But it's a good kind of temptation, as I've always said. You know, you could be tempted by a lot worse than books. Books are good for you. And if you go to audiblepodcast.com/Dan Carlin, you can learn how to become addicted to books with a 30-day free trial. As I said, audiblepodcast.com/Dan Carlin, but don't say I didn't warn you.
Do you shop online at Amazon.com? If you do, consider doing so through the Amazon search window on DanCarlin.com.
Are you feeling guilty yet? Come on, a buck a show. That's all we ask.
If you are not already following us on Twitter, please do so. The address is @DC Common Sense.